This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Now then, the qualifications. Item one, a cheery disposition. I am never cross. Item two, rosy cheeks. Obviously. Item three, play games all sorts. Well, I'm sure the children will find my games extremely diverting.
That's my guest Julie Andrews in Mary Poppins interviewing for the job of a nanny, a very magical nanny, as it turns out. Mary Poppins was Julie Andrews' first film. Her second was released the following year, 1965. This time, she was a nun turned governess, a very life-affirming governess.
All right, everybody, over here.
What are we going to do?
Let's think of something to sing for the Baroness when she comes.
Father doesn't like us to sing.
Well, perhaps we can change his mind. Now, what songs do you know?
We don't know any songs.
Not any?
We don't even know how to sing.
No.
Well, let's not lose any time. You must learn.
But how?
Let's start at the very beginning. A very good place to start. When you read, you begin.
That's Julie Andrews in The Sound of Music. Andrews has written a memoir about her early years called Home. It's filled with surprises about her family life and tells how she got started in vaudeville in her parents' act, then went to Broadway when she was still a teenager, where she soon originated the role of Eliza Doolittle in My Fair Lady. She's still making movies, like The Princess Diaries and Enchanted, in which she's the narrator. But Julie Andrews can't sing anymore. That part of her life ended after surgery on her vocal cords. Julie Andrews, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, in reading your memoir, I have to say your family life isn't at all what I imagined it would be. I mean, I thought you'd be from a kind of proper, straight-laced family based on my idea of who you were from your roles. And I wonder what you think your image is and if my mistake is a common one.
It is a common one, and a lot of people have been surprised about the book. If you know me very well, you can probably spot that my background is real good, down-and-out vaudeville music hall background. But a lot of people, because of their association with the wonderful films like Mary Poppins and Sound of Music, they think that I am this very squeaky, clean, upper-class lady that came from such a family, and it's so far from the truth.
Let's start with the fact that two of your grandparents died of syphilis.
Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, my background is really Dickensian in so many ways. I was surprised when I found out those facts.
What was your understanding of syphilis when you were a child and found out how your grandfather died?
Well, I think it was kept very much from me. I mean, It was a sort of a subject that we didn't talk about. And being a young kid, we certainly didn't talk about it. And so it was somewhat of a mystery. It was that awful thing that was just out there. And it wasn't until I was older that I began to really grasp its significance and the horror of it and what it must have been like. I do know that my aunt, and I write this in the book, said that she didn't want to discuss my grandfather's death because he was in a sanatorium that was really a sort of madhouse in those days. I mean, you have to think how many years ago this all took place. And the conditions were appalling, and people were very, very disturbed and mentally ill, and he apparently had a very nasty time of it and passed away there.
Now, your mother was a pianist, and she left her father to perform with a singer named Ted Andrews, who she later married. And they left home during World War II when you were young to perform for the troops. You stayed with your father and your aunt. What was it like to have your mother leave during wartime?
Well, I was I'm going to sound a real Pollyanna here, but I was raised during the war. I mean, I was practically born into the war. I think I was 2 years old or something when war broke out. But so I knew nothing else, Terry. It was not so unusual to be raised in war because all my peers were being raised the same way. And we all were in it together. I mean, we went down into the bomb shelters together. We went down into the subway, the underground, together and took refuge from the bombs that were dropping all over London. And so it was part of what we did to survive. And it was scary to hear the crunch of bombs, and to this day, a fire siren, you know, one of those wailing sirens that goes off when there is a fire in the area, evokes tremendous memories. But I don't know if it was an indelible imprint that forever left me challenged, if you know what I mean.
Will you describe how, after your mother brought you to London, where she was living with the man who became your stepfather, you learned how to distinguish the sound of the British fighter planes from the German fighter planes?
That's right.
And you'd warn everybody by blowing a whistle when a German plane was coming. That was probably a pretty important role that you could play.
Well,
as a
child. Was sent out in all weathers, regardless of, you know, rain or shine or hail or snow. I was sent out by my mother. You have to understand that women toward the end of the war could accomplish nothing because the air raid sirens were coming so furiously, and every half hour the siren would go off and a woman would be baking a cake or doing her laundry or any number of things, and she'd have to take it out of the oven or turn off stop washing her clothes and so on. And so it interrupted everything. And my mother had this great idea that she knew that I could distinguish the difference between a German doodlebug, as they were called in those days, those pilotless planes that came over and just dropped on London and around London. And I could tell the difference between that and one of our fighter pilots. And so she sent me out to sit on top of our air raid shelter with a pair of opera glasses, which were absolutely no good at all, and an umbrella and a whistle. And when I heard the German planes coming, I blew the whistle, which gave her a little bit more time to get on with anything she was doing. But, of course, there came a day when I truly rebelled and said, I'm not going to do it. It's too wet and it's too cold out there. And after the bomb had dropped in our neighborhood, we had a few irate neighbors coming around to our door saying, why didn't she blow her whistle? We were relying on it. So I had to keep doing it from then on.
Your stepfather became an alcoholic and became abusive. He beat your younger brother with a cane. And you write, I did nothing to stop the beatings, which lasted so long that I suspected Pop enjoyed it or could not stop himself. I did nothing for fear of taking sides, for fear that if I reached out, I might be the next recipient. My brain would turn on a dime and I would think, well, my brother had been naughty. So, looking back in retrospect as an adult on how you didn't do anything to intervene as a child, is there anything you really could have done as a child?
No, I think one just felt guilty that the fact that my mother did nothing about it, that I did nothing about it, that my aunt who lived close by did nothing about it, and this sad, well, there were two brothers that were pretty badly. It didn't happen an enormous amount, but the fact that it happened at all is appalling, and the child was a rebel of sorts, but he was the middle boy, and life was turbulent, and any middle child probably with that kind of existence is going to act out, and it was just, I knew it was wrong, I knew it was sad, and I wished I could have done something about it, and I think I did feel guilty that I didn't try to stop it, but I you're right, I don't think I could have done anything about it.
Your stepfather beat your brother with a cane. You had your own run-in with your stepfather. Twice he came into your bedroom, climbed into your bed, and told you...
Well, he didn't climb into my bed, but he certainly made an advance. Thank God, at that point, he did not climb into my bed. And
But he told you that you needed to be taught how to kiss?
Yes, he did. That was, but he was not in my bed, thank God. That would have been very difficult. But I was able to... you have to remember, he was an alcoholic, and there were days when he wasn't an alcoholic, and he did a lot of things to further my career, to try to help me in many ways. But, of course, because he was a stepfather, because he was seemingly a dangerous man in the family presence, I didn't like him that much, particularly not at first. And thank God he was decent enough somewhere to... pull back, and I was only abused in that he did try to kiss me, and he would have probably come into bed, but I had a lock put on the door and a few things like that, and it only happened twice, mercifully.
How did you get him out of your room?
I kind of joshed him. Thank you. Now, come on. It's time that I get to bed. And I don't know what I said, really, but I do know that there was a kind of pushing and a gentle shoving. And I didn't want to make waves. I know that I wanted to just get him out of the room and climb into the safety of my bed and face the wall, so to speak.
You told your aunt about this, and you assume that she told your mother.
Yes, she lived on our property, and my mother was away.
How come you told your aunt? Some people would be so afraid that they would just keep it a secret from anybody and carry the burden of the secret for decades.
Well, I wasn't threatened in that sense. He didn't say, don't tell anybody. He didn't say, you'll be in trouble if you do. It was none of that. I mean, he was drunk, and it was just a bad moment in his life and in mine, but thank God, had enough sense to say, Auntie, what do I do about this?
My guest is Julie Andrews, and she's written a new memoir. It's called Home, A Memoir of My Early Years. When your parents, when your mother and your stepfather brought you into their vaudeville act, who were you in the act? Like, what was your role? What kind of stuff did you sing?
I think I started doing this. My father began to give me singing lessons when I was about 7 years. My stepfather began to give me singing lessons when I was about 7 years old. He was a fine singer, and my mother was a wonderful pianist in my youth. She was a really good concert pianist, and she and my stepfather formed this vaudeville act, which became pretty successful all around England and on the boards and also on radio, which was very big in those days. And he began giving me singing lessons at the age of about seven and was so surprised to discover that I had unusually powerful adult larynx. He very quickly realized that it probably would be a smart thing to give me over to a fine singing teacher. And that good lady was my teacher until the day she died at age 90-something or other. So for many, many decades, she was my teacher. And she taught well and gave me a great technique. So when I went on the boards with my parents for the first time, I was about nine. And my stepfather, who was a good salesman, too. He went out and spoke with the front-of-house manager of whatever town, whatever theater they were playing in whatever town they were, and asked permission to bring their young daughter onto the stage that night. And he announced to the audience that he had a surprise for the audience, that his and my mother's young daughter were was traveling with them for the holidays or something like that. And they wanted to invite me on the stage to sing a duet, and I sang a duet with my stepfather. And I was so small that they put me on a sort of wooden beer crate, I think, or a bottle crate anyway, to reach the microphone beside him. And we belted out a song called Come to the Fair, which was a duet, and it went down pretty well, and I seemed to enjoy it, and the audience seemed to love it, so things progressed from there.
Your singing teacher, who was your singing teacher for decades, you describe how she helped you place your voice. Can you describe a little bit what that process was?
Well, it went on for many, many years, and she gave me a great foundation, good placement of voice, good attention to lyrics, particularly. Well, both vowels and consonants. If you have trouble with a certain note, her technique was to practice usually the note before it. If you have trouble hitting a high note at the end of a song, then work on the penultimate note, which, with a good strong foundation and being placed correctly, will allow the high note to follow it in exactly the same position and place. As I say, vowels, one had to be very true to them and hold them firmly and precede them with strong consonants. I say in the book, which is probably the best example I can give, We used to practice a lot of Handel's music because he also had great words to his beautiful music, and we'd practice the Messiah, for instance. And if I was singing, "Behold, thy king cometh unto thee," I would do a very strong B on the behold, and the O of hold would be strong, and thy king, the TH would be strong, and would pull the Y of thy forward, and following a note to its absolute end, and then just literally cutting off the breath so that you didn't swallow it at the end of the sound. Many, many, many details like that.
It's so interesting that on the one hand, you're studying, you're getting this great classical training with your teacher, singing Handel, and at the same time, you're performing in your parents' vaudeville act.
But, you know,
nice mix.
My gimmick and my stock in trade in those days was to belt out somewhat, you know, cut and bastardized versions of the great arias. I sang Caronome from Rigoletto. I sang the great aria from Traviata, Sempre Libre. I'm sorry, I couldn't remember the name for a second. And my great stock in trade was the Polonaise from the opera Mignon. And that had a phenomenally high note at the end of it and usually brought the house down.
So it was almost like a stunt, a kid singing all these difficult adult arias.
Exactly. And when I finally went out in my own act at about age 15 something rather sad happened, which was that my parents, we used to be billed as Ted and Barbara Andrews, my mother and my stepfather, with Julie. And eventually the billing would say Julie Andrews with Ted and Barbara. And that must have just been dreadful for my stepfather. It must have, you know, castrated him dreadfully, I would think.
Hmm. Well, you know, he did some really bad things to you and your brother, but at the same time, he gave you the singing lessons. And,
oh, tried to be kind. I just wouldn't have any of it, I'm afraid, because I, as I say, he was overwhelming and a big man, a powerful man, and a little frightening in that sense.
You know, I'm wondering, since so many actors draw on their own experiences for roles, how did some of the problems that you faced as a child that we've been discussing affect you when you were filming classics like Mary Poppins and like Sound of Music?
Well, this may sound very Pollyanna-ish, but I think I always had a great capacity for joy in my life. My father, my supposed father, was the sanest, wisest, kindest gentleman who was a nature-loving man, loved the country. And the whole family had a great sense of humor. And other than the exceptions that I've mentioned, life wasn't terrible. People have had far, far worse, much worse upbringings than mine. Mine was unusual and full of wonderful characters, but I never considered it a bad or difficult childhood. It was a childhood, and because of those vaudeville days when the whole attitude was that the show must go on and we must all get on with it, and you go through everything that comes at you because what choice do you have? I never sort of wallowed in any of it, and I really did enjoy my life very much, and it was full of kind of wonderful magic for me. You can imagine being that young and having a freak, an odd, very large singing voice, very strong, very powerful, that was able to do all these amazing sort of calisthenics and coloratura scales and arias and cadenzas and so on. Life was fun to some extent. I was different. I was. It stood me in good stead at my school. We traveled a great deal all over England, and it was in pretty tacky circumstances. The digs were awful, and we put up with a great deal, but we did manage, and somehow I think all that background in vaudeville, all the touring, all the getting through it, gave me an awareness of how lucky I was when those wonderful films were offered to me. They were the wonderful sort of passport or lifeline that gave me my life, and I was full of joy.
You went to New York at the age of about 20?
No, I 19? I came in my when I was just about to turn 19, and the show that I was in was a show called The Boyfriend, a product that was brought over from England. It had been a huge success in London. It was a sort of loving nod to the 1920s, a little pastiche, a little piece of lace. And the original cast was still playing in London to enormous success. And the American producers were not able to secure that cast for their show in New York. So a completely new cast was assembled. And I was lucky enough to be asked to play the leading role in The Boyfriend. And I was 19 the day after we opened. So the great notices that the show received were like the most wonderful birthday gift.
And after doing The Boyfriend on Broadway, you did My Fair Lady.
Yes.
So did you have to audition or did they just give you a part?
Oh, gosh, no. No, I did many auditions. I sang for Alan Lerner, and then I went up to sing for Frederick Lowe with Alan. And then I read a lot of scenes and dialogue scenes with Alan, who somehow, God knows how, because I'd never done a play before. I'd never played a character. I'd never done a role in a really legitimate piece. All I knew was how to belt out an aria on a vaudeville stage, and that was it.
But what about The Boyfriend? You'd been in that.
Well, I'd done The Boyfriend, and I'd had a year's experience, that's true. But again, I staggered through The Boyfriend, learning on my feet as I went. Mm-hmm. And then you can imagine that George Bernard Shaw was 100 times, you know, stronger and more important than that, and I was really floundering. But I think because of my voice, because they sensed something maybe in my makeup, they felt that I could do Eliza, and so I was offered the role. And I'm sure I wasn't the first, but I was the lucky one that landed it.
You read in your book that you didn't know how to do a Cockney accent.
Yes.
Which is funny. I mean, yeah. Go ahead.
Give me a break. I was so busy learning who I was and what I was doing and never had the opportunity to do that before. And although I had a very good ear and had perfect pitch and many things that helped me, so helped me, I couldn't do a Cockney accent.
So who taught you?
An American professor of phonetics, my own American Henry Higgins, a weird reversal of the Pygmalion story.
And what's the first thing what's the basic principle he taught you?
Oh, gosh, now that's a hard question to answer. I don't think I can. Just literally taking me through the lines of the play and widening vowels, shortening them, dropping H's and all of those. I'm pretty sure that my general overall Cockney was not great, but it got me by. Perhaps more so in America because not many Americans know a genuine Cockney accent. But I had a tougher time by the time I took the play to England, but by then I'd had a lot of learning experience, so I fared better.
Did your coach give you advice on how to sing Wouldn't It Be Lovely?
No. No. Funnily enough, he didn't, as far as I can recall. Alan Lerner had written the lyrics to sound Cockney, you know, ow, wouldn't it be lovely.
So it was written like O-W?
O-W-W, I think. Or E-O-W, I'm not quite sure which. But whatever, it was written so that I knew it had to be sung, of course, in Cockney. And just you white Henry Higgins and all of that was written the same way. So that was not so difficult because I was singing, and B, I'd learned enough from my dialect coach to know what I had to do.
Well, why don't we hear Wouldn't It Be Lovely?
All I want is a room somewhere far away from the cold night air with one enormous chair. Wouldn't it be lovely? Lots of chocolate. lots of coal, making lots of it. Warm face, warm hands, warm feet, wouldn't it be lovely? Oh, so lovely, sitting abso-blooming lewdly still. I would never budge till spring crept over me windowsill. Someone's head resting on my knee, warm and tender as he can be, who takes good care of me. Oh, wouldn't it be lovely, 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 lovely.
That's Julie Andrews singing Wouldn't It Be Lovely from the original Broadway cast recording of My Fair Lady. You know, it's such a really, like, lovely tune.
Isn't it pretty?
Yeah. Did you when you were given the song to sing, did you say, great song, it'll be a classic?
No. I did say great song. I knew it was lovely. I knew all the music for My Fair Lady was wonderful. I knew it was special and that these gentlemen were supremely talented. I mean, can you imagine hearing I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face for the first time?
Oh, man, what a great song.
I know. Yeah. And why can't a woman be more like a man? And why can't the English teach their children how to speak? I mean, phenomenal lyrics.
Now, when My Fair Lady was adapted into a film, you didn't get the part. I don't know if you wanted it or not, but it went to Audrey
Hepburn. There's no doubt about the fact that I would have loved to have played Eliza on film, but I really, at the time, understood the choice to not go with an unknown, because although I was fairly well known on Broadway, but I was only really just making my name, certainly I wasn't known in the world or in the movie industry. And in those days, a star was required, and Audrey was asked to do the role, and we became great friends, Audrey Hepburn and I.
Good.
And she said to me one day, oh, Julie, you should have done it, but I didn't have the guts to turn it down, which was lovely and charming of her, and I completely understood why she was asked to do it.
And she ended up being dubbed by Marnie Nixon. Now,
Her singing voice.
On the other hand, when The Sound of Music was adapted from stage to film, Mary Martin didn't get cast in the movie. You got the movie role. Yeah. So did you feel bad about Mary Martin?
I did. Just for a moment, Terry. Yes, I did think, oh, my, I wonder how she feels about this. But for whatever reason, she had done it on stage just as I had done My Fair Lady. She probably felt pretty bad, too.
Let's get back to our interview with Julie Andrews. She has a new memoir about her early years called Home. Here she is in one of her most famous performances from the movie The Sound of Music.
With songs they have sung for a thousand years. The hills fill my heart with the sound of music. My heart wants to sing every song it hears. My heart wants to beat like the wings of the birds that rise from the lake to the trees. My heart wants to sigh like a chime that flies from a church on a breeze. To laugh like a brook when it trips and falls over stones on its way. To sing through the night like a lark who is learning to pray. I go to the hills when my heart is low.
Now, the The Sound of Music provokes very strong reactions in people. People tend to just, like, love the film or not because they think it's too saccharine. So
I know.
So where do you fit in on the scale?
I know how hard we all tried recognizing that there was a saccharine quality to it. I mean, you have a whole, you know, a whole family of children and a nanny governess and a lot of countryside and a lot of religious ladies flying around the place, and you're going to get a bit of saccharine there, that's for sure. And we all knew that even though the music was lovely, that we had to play, if possible, against that saccharine quality. And I know that Christopher Plummer, I certainly, we did our utmost to push it away somewhere. I remember distinctly one scene where I really wanted Maria to be absolutely horrified that she was going to have to take care of seven children, because that's the way somebody would have reacted, I think. I mean, you know, being nanny to one child is enough, but seven. So we did try, and we were aware that there were saccharine moments, but then the beauty of Sound of Music was that the scenery was so gorgeous, and we did film in Austria, and we had a symphony orchestra playing all that glorious music, and that saccharine quality was compensated for a million ways.
Let me ask you about what might be the most famous shot from the film, which is used on advertising posters, and it's a picture of you while singing The Sound of Music with your arms out, twirling around alone in the mountains.
That's right, in the very, very cold, rainy, wet mountains.
Talk about that shot.
Oh, well, that shot, the bulk of that shot was filmed from a helicopter. And I would start at one end of this long field, and the helicopter would start at the other end of the field, and we would come towards each other. The very brave cameraman was hanging out of the side of the helicopter where the door would normally be, strapped in with a camera attached to his chest, and the helicopter sort of came at me sideways, rather sort of crab-like, edging its way towards me, as I walked towards it and executed that famous, now famous, turn just before singing. And we did that shot many times to be sure that the focus was right and that everything about it was right. But the trouble was that once that shot had been completed and we each went back to our own respective ends of the field to start again, the downdraft from the helicopter circling around me dashed me off my feet and into the grass. It was so strong. Now, this is fine for, you know, one or two takes, but after about four or five takes, I began to get quite angry about it and thought, you know, there must be a way that I don't have to be leveled every time we finish this shot. So I signaled to the pilot to please make a wider circle around me. And all I got was a thumbs up and, you know, great, I think we got it, but let's do it one more time. And I bit the dust and I sort of spat mud and hay and everything else for every single take of that particular shot.
That's so great because the story behind the shot is so different than the shot itself.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like you're suffering to do it.
There's a lot of things about The Sound of Music that had that, though. I mean, the weather was not great in the mountains particularly, and it rained a great deal of the time, and we would sit under tarpaulins and manage to get through a day with sometimes just 30 seconds of film footage, and it was cold and it was damp. But the clouds and their strength and the beauty that they brought to the film itself was a gift that, I mean, if we'd just been a sunny postcard, I mean, it was a postcard enough, but it gave texture to the movie, which helped enormously.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Julie Andrews, and her new memoir is about her early years, and it's called Home. You had such a lovely singing voice, and you haven't been able to sing since about 2005. You had surgery to remove a node on one of your vocal cords and haven't been able to sing since, and I understand you sued your surgeon because of that. I figure it must have been really difficult for you to not be able to sing. I mean, obviously that affected you professionally, but just like personally and emotionally, what did it mean for you to not be able to do that anymore?
It wasn't a node. I didn't have cancerous nodes as so many people think I did. I just had a small sort of cyst in my, seemingly I had a cyst in my vocal cords, and even that is now has been proved to be rather suspect. But I'm not allowed to talk about the operation itself, but because of, you know, lawyers and people like that would ask me not to. But I can tell you that it was, of course, devastating. I'm very glad it happened toward the end of my singing life rather than at the beginning. I miss singing with an orchestra enormously. I think I was in denial for a year or two, thinking that perhaps I was just taking longer to heal than most people, that my throat was a little more sensitive than most. But then there did come a day when I had to begin living with it, and I live with it to this day. I guess in the sort of old tradition of vaudevillians, I could give up and crawl away, or I could make what was left of my life something decent. And I wondered what I was meant to learn from it. Perhaps there was a lesson in it all. God knows what that was. But I did begin to write more, and it allowed me time to write this autobiography. And I've kept very busy. I seem to be busier these days than I've ever been, and I don't get it, but I'm extremely grateful.
Well, you're still making movies, you know.
That's right.
Can't forget about that.
The Princess Diaries, and I do go out on speaking engagements, which I enjoy very much, and I'm a huge advocate for literacy and bringing art into schools for children and helping school libraries, which were so underfunded. Everything about the arts is underfunded, it seems.
One more thing before we have to let you go. The 1982 movie Victor Victoria that you starred in, you played a woman pretending to be a man, pretending to be a woman. You played a woman pretending to be a man performing in drag. And with the help of that movie, as even the Wikipedia points out, you've become an icon for family films and also something of an icon in the gay and lesbian community because of Victor Victoria and maybe also because of Sing Along Sound of Music.
Seem to have sort of covered the whole spectrum somehow.
So is that a surprise to you that you're both?
I'm delighted. I'm just thrilled by it. I think it's the nicest thing that could happen. And, you know, that squeaky clean image, which was brought about by such lovely films that were so successful, such as Poppins and Sound of Music, I'm hoping that the body of work that I've done since then has kind of dispelled that squeaky clean myth. But I'm delighted to be embraced by families, by kids, by the gay culture, by everyone. And people are genuinely lovely when I meet them. I love going out and lecturing and meeting people and talking about my work and so on. It's a great pleasure.
Well, it's been wonderful to talk with you. Thank you so much.
And you, Terry. Thank you so much.
Julie Andrews' new memoir is called Home. You can read an excerpt of it on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. This is Fresh Air. Many of us grew up thinking of Charlton Heston as Moses.
From the burning bush, O Lord, you charged me to bring the people to this holy mountain, to behold your glory and receive your law. What have I left undone?
That's a scene from the Ten Commandments. Charlton Heston's booming voice reverberated in other biblical epics like Ben-Hur and The Greatest Story Ever Told. He was not only close to God in his movies, he played the genius Michelangelo in The Agony and the Ecstasy. He was a cop in Orson Welles' Touch of Evil, a lonely cowboy in Will Penny. He was the pursued in The Planet of the Apes and was subjected to earthquakes and airplane catastrophes in the disaster films of the 70s. Off-screen, Heston became famous for his opposition to gun control. In 1998, he was elected president of the National Rifle Association and served 4 terms. Charlton Heston died Saturday. He was 84. I spoke with him in 1990 and asked him about shooting the scene in the Ten Commandments in which he led the exodus of Jews out of Egypt.
I've had 8,000 human beings and 5,000 animals, and it took to get the shots with all those people, you could only do about 5 takes a day, because you to get them back to where they started from took hours. And it's the kind of film that obviously can never be made again. They won't ever make Lawrence of Arabia or Bridge in the River Kwai or Ben-Hur or any of those films again, because they're far, far too expensive.
I'd like to ask you about the chariot race scene in Ben-Hur, which is, Ben-Hur won, 11 Academy Awards, mm-hmm. and the chariot race scene has always been considered one of the really important action sequences.
Yeah. Category for chariot races, though.
You're right. you had to learn how to actually drive a chariot for this?
Yes, I went over some 6 weeks before we started shooting, and Yakima Kanat, who directed the race sequence, personally taught me to drive. And by the time we were ready to begin the picture, I was a minimally competent charioteer. But as I pointed out to Yak one day while we were resting the horses after working a couple of hours with him, I said, you know, Yak, I can handle this team pretty well now, but there's just the one team out here. And when we start shooting this sucker, there's going to be 8 other teams, and I'm not so sure about I can cut that or not. And he looked at me and he said, Chuck, you just stay in the chariot. I guarantee you're going to win the damn race. As indeed I did.
So was everybody, were most of the other drivers stunt drivers so they could get out of your way
indeed,
real quick?
All of them. Mm-hmm. Steve Boyd, who unhappily had not been cast until he only had about 3 weeks work in the chariot. But he drove some sequences as well.
Mm-hmm.
What was an accident was I drove a great deal of the sequences,
mm-hmm.
but the scene where Ben-Hur is thrown out of the chariot when it jumps the wreck was not planned. He was not supposed to go out of the chariot, but he was accidentally thrown out with Groot, and I didn't do that. Joe Kanat, Yak's son, but Joe was thrown out of the chariot, managed to throw himself clear, and was only scratched. If the chariot had run over him, it would have killed him because those things weighed 0.5 ton with steel wheels. But then Wyler, who of course directed the picture, saw that footage, and he said, we got to use that shot. And Jack said, I thought Ben-Hur was supposed to win this sucker, Willie. How are we going to get him back in the chariot? And Willie said, well, we'll cut before he falls absolutely clear and have Chuck get in the tongue and climb back in, which I did very quickly.
Did that look convincing to you when it was cut together?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's totally convincing. It was not my favorite shot to do, I'll tell you, but it's totally convincing.
You had to climb back in as the chariot was moving.
Yes, but I was on the tongue of the chariot between the horses and the chariot itself.
In the 70s, you starred in several of the disaster films, including Earthquake, which was one of the first. How did you end up being in, what was it, four
we
of the
were
films?
All in disaster films. The reason for that is very clear. Disaster films are, in essence, multiple Jeopardy stories. You take a natural disaster or a man-made disaster or a threatening circumstance and put a cast of disparate characters, a dozen or 15 people who don't know each other, most of them. And the point of the story is how they respond to the circumstances. And it's a perfectly valid genre. But if you're making a movie about it, you have these 12 or 15 people, and you introduce each one in a scene in the beginning. They're usually not in the same scene because they don't know each other. They're not supposed to. That's part of the idea. Then you often don't see them again for 30 minutes. And if they come up again, you don't want the audience saying, let's see, who was that? Was that that fire chief in the beginning? And the guy said, then they want to say, no, that was Steve McQueen, dummy. This is Paul Newman. He plays the architect. And for that, you need very high-profile, very well-known actors. And we all did at least 2 of them. And finally, they used up all the possible stories, and the audience got tired of them. And I think we were all tired of them, too, by then. But we made an awful lot of money out of them.
In Earthquake, you actually asked for your character to be killed at the end.
Well, I thought, you know, I said, I didn't ask. I had script approval.
Oh, you did?
Oh, sure.
Oh.
And I said, come on, guys, this is ridiculous. I play this nice architect who knows there's going to be an earthquake and they got to build the buildings differently, and he has this terrible wife and this nice mistress. And at the end of the picture, the earthquake proves that he's right about the buildings, and it kills his mean wife, and he gets to go on into a happy future designing earthquake-proof buildings with this beautiful Canadian girl, Geneviève Bujold. And I said, I said, let's surprise him a little. Let's have him killed, too. And so they did.
Did you have to work hard to convince them?
Mm-hmm. I did.
Charlton Heston recorded in 1990. He died Saturday at the age of 84.